This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his Old Testament History and Literature course, lecture number 13, on the book of Leviticus.
Okay, class, let's get started here. We've got a lot to do today. We're going to try to cover the book of Leviticus, which is the most fascinating book in the Old Testament. We're going to try to make a dance today for us and stuff. For Thursday's quiz, what do we have up? Oh, Thursday. Oh, that's right. It's quad break. Okay, so you have Thursdays off. Merry Christmas. For the following Thursday, you're working on the book of Joshua. Joshua is about 24 chapters. It's not that big or bad and stuff. There's an article there on the concept of war, and so that might be interesting to you. War and loving your neighbor as yourself kind of thing, putting those two ideas together. And then there's also some memory verses. Psalm 100 starts out like, make a joyful noise to the Lord. So it's another famous psalm, not quite as famous as Psalm 23, but there's a couple verses. And then Joshua 1:8, which is a really classic verse in the book of Joshua. So you guys will be working on Joshua. I'm going to start trying to catch up with you guys. I'll probably never catch up with you all semester, but I'm going to start moving faster. We'll get a good chunk of the book of Leviticus done today, probably not the whole thing. So that's, you guys are working on Joshua. We'll jump back and pick up Exodus, finish up Exodus and get into Leviticus today. And before we do that, let's open with a word of prayer, and then we'll get down to it, okay? Father, we thank you for this day. We thank you for your kindnesses to us and giving us your word. We pray for our brothers and sisters in Egypt that are struggling this day under persecution, churches being burned, Christians being killed. We remember our brothers and sisters, and we pray that you might protect them, and that you might give them a sense of meaning and purpose amidst all the chaos that's going down there now. Help us in this class as we go over the book of Leviticus. I pray you might help me to explain it in a way that is good, that is accurate, and reflects your holiness and your goodness. You are a holy God. It is a great privilege to call you Father, and to know that you gave your Son, Jesus Christ, on our behalf. And it's in his precious name that we pray. Amen. Okay, let's finish up the book of Exodus. And what I'd like to do is kind of introduce this one law in Exodus. And this is called a case law. Okay, what is a case law? Do you realize there's law like thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness? Those are general principle laws. There's a whole other type of law that's called case law. And a case law goes like this. If Johnny drinks and Johnny drives, Johnny will get put in jail. Okay? It's an if-then type of law that gives you specific cases. That's why they call it case law. Okay? If the person does this, then this will happen. And they call that case law then. If-then, with specific cases that are happening. So what we have in chapter 21 here is a specific case law. Okay? And let me just read the passage from Exodus chapter 21, verse 22. It says, if men who are fighting, so you've got two guys fighting, if men who are fighting hit a pregnant woman, okay, so you've got two guys fighting. And what happens probably? The woman tries to break it up or whatever. She gets into the fight. So you got two guys fighting. And then if the woman who's pregnant gets hit and she gives birth prematurely, but there is no serious injury, the offender must be fined. The guy who hits the pregnant woman must be fined, whatever the woman's husband demands and the court allows. But if there is serious injury, you are to take life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, and bruise for bruise. We would call that the what? The lex talionis. Do you remember the eye for eye, tooth for tooth? This is actually listed here. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, burn for burn. And this is called the lex talionis, okay? The law of retaliation. The law of retaliation in this case law. Now, what is actually going on here? You've got two guys fighting. This woman jumps in. She tries to break up the fight. The guy punches her. Now, it says there's two situations that come out of that. One is if there's no injury to whom? The guy is fined that hit her. He has to pay a fine. There's no injury to the woman, but the woman apparently miscarries or has a child, and the child, it's assumed here that the child dies, okay? So then the guy who hit her has to pay a fine. So that what happens is you have here a situation where basically this premature birth thing with a baby suffering an injury, most likely death, because they, you know, premature back then, I mean, they don't do the preemies like we do in hospitals today that save the life of the mother and the baby. Back then, the baby dies and stuff. But notice what the penalty is. The penalty is that the fee be paid. And so then this raises the question about the fetus. Is the fetus a person before the fetus is born? And the fetus is now, there's been a miscarriage and stuff as a result of getting hit and things. And so notice a fee is charged here that's arranged by the husband. So apparently it's negotiable. This fee is negotiable, and it may depend on, you know, what month she was, if it were early or whether it was later and things like that. Does this passage have, let me do one more thing here. But if the woman is hit, and we said, and there's damage done to her, basically, well, let's just go back. So the woman is hit, then it's eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. Eye for an eye, tooth for tooth for the woman if she's damaged. Now, why would there be less for the fetus that dies? Why would there be less of a penalty? By the way, in that culture too, if a slave gets hurt, was there a fee paid for a slave being hurt, rather than eye for an eye, tooth for tooth? So is there certain hierarchy in terms of how the law is applied? Okay. Now, does this passage have anything to tell us about the abortion issue? And people have used this passage on abortion. Is abortion really the question here? Is this passage addressing the abortion issue? No, it's not. Two guys are fighting. A woman gets in the middle, and bam, they hit her, and she has a child. Now, let me just work another aspect of this. Does intent matter in terms of punishment? Okay, I'm driving down Grapevine Road. There's a kid riding his bicycle. I'm driving down Grapevine Road like I do every day. The kid, all of a sudden, out of clear blue, just turns his thing and swerves right in front of me, and I hit the kid. I kill the kid. The kid's under my car. I just killed the kid. Question, do I go to jail for the rest of my life for murdering that kid? Probably. Do I probably regret that for the rest of my life? Yes. But do I go to jail for that? Why? Now, by the way, in that situation, did I kill a kid? I killed the kid. Question, do I go to jail for murder? Why don't I go to jail for murder?
You go to jail for manslaughter.
Okay. Because what?
You go to jail for manslaughter.
You go to jail for manslaughter? You go to jail? Would I go to jail? Here, if the kid swerved right in front of me like that? Are you kidding me? Oh, yeah. All right. You guys, all right. A little paranoid now. But by the way, part of my defense would be, was it my fault? Was there anything I could do? My brakes are good in my car. You understand? I probably couldn't even hit my brakes. The kid just wham, bam, and it's over. Okay. Question. Was there any malice and aforethought? Was there any malice and aforethought? Do malice and aforethought count? Yes. Okay. Yes. Now, is it possible, suppose my brakes were bad and my brakes couldn't stop the car? Would you call that what? A negligent, you know, negligence? There could be negligence and things like that. But in that case, there was no malice or forethought and things. Now, let's go back to the woman getting hit. The guy's getting the woman off his back. This woman's trying to pull this guy off from hitting her husband or something. And he goes wham and he gives her an elbow or something like that. Question, is the guy trying to hurt the woman to get the woman off his back? Yeah, so for her, it goes eye to eye. Question, he hits the baby and the baby miscarriages. Was there any intent against the baby? There's no intent against the child. So in other words, yes, the woman, he was trying to hit her, but he wasn't necessarily trying to hit the baby. And so I think there's a distinction there between those two. And so a fine is given for the child, for the infant stuff. Does this have anything to do with abortion? No, it doesn't. And so you have to be really careful about pulling verses out like this and using them for purposes for which they were not given. This is not given to give us, you know, the Bible's explanation of abortion. This, by the way, does this have to do with a fetus? Yes, it does, but it's not given for that purpose. And I think you got to be really careful about pulling verses out like this and using them for purposes for which they're not designed. Okay, that's my point for this. Be careful about pulling things out of context in the Scripture and using them for a different context that which they were not designed. So Okay, so that's this is called a case law. If two men are fighting, and if the guy slugs the woman, then this is what it's called. So this is case law. If then, if this happens, then this happens, then this would be the punishment for that. So this is, okay, so basically the implications for the fetus is human. This does not have, it's not really addressed that issue. The point, that's not the point of this. Although, is the fetus valued? Is the fetus valued? Yes, but it doesn't answer the whole question about, you know, the questions that come up from that. So, and by the way, I'm very much, very, very strongly pro-life and things like that. But what I'm saying is you got to be careful. Develop good arguments. Don't use verses like this that aren't good to use. So, okay, now over to Leviticus. Leviticus, the most fun book in the Old Testament. Okay. I'm going to try to make this interesting, the book of Leviticus, okay? Actually, to be honest with you, once upon a time I taught a whole course on the book of Leviticus and things. And actually, we had a great time with it. But the problem is the book of Leviticus, thousands of years from our culture. And this is where it comes up. The book of Leviticus, the major theme of the book is this: be holy as I, the Lord your God, am holy. This is the major theme, is basically holiness. By the way, this book is called Leviticus. If you take the cuss off the end here, who is the book about in the book of Leviticus? It's about Levites and who would be the other group of people? Levites and priests. What's the difference? Levites are, what are Levites? They're of the tribe of Levi. So they're Levites are of the tribe of Levi. What are the priests? Where did the priests come from? Aaron's descendants, yeah. So Aaron is a Levite, but Aaron's descendants are the priests. Okay, so Aaron was designated as a high priest. His children, his children's children become the priests. So Aaron's descendants are the priests, the Levites. The Levites carry the tabernacle. The Levites carry the tabernacle stuff. The priests actually do what? The priests minister at the altar and in the Holy of Holies and things like that. The priests actually get engaged, whereas the Levites are the ones that haul the tabernacle and that kind of stuff. So what we know, external religion. External religion. Is religion uniquely personal and private with few external requirements? In our culture, have we privatized religion? In our culture, have we privatized religion? Is it almost out of place to speak in the public arena about one's religion? Is it almost, have they silenced, in as far as a public expression, articulation of Christianity, has it almost been silenced in the public arena? And your religion is supposed to be what? Something that's personal and private, that you keep to yourself. It's kind of funny in our culture, isn't it? Question, is it more inappropriate to speak about religion in public or actually see sexual acts in public? Which is more accepted by our culture? Yeah, did you get the irony there? Okay, I'm sorry, but our culture is much more, it's incredible. Something that should be very private is made public, and it's okay. Something that should be public has now been silenced in some senses. And so this is something I want you to think about in terms of how religious expression has been silenced in our culture. It's been very purposeful, and I've watched it happen over 40 years, and it's been very particular. Until now, it's almost impossible to speak about religion in public. Does religion have external things, though? Does religion have its external expression, or is it only personal and private? Here's another one. What is the cult in the Old Testament? Now, when I use the word cult, oftentimes people's heads go to, when I use the word cult, does anybody go back to remember this guy Jimmy Jones and drinking Kool-Aid and then all these people that are dead, you know, and stuff? That's a cult, right? A cult of following and things, people brainwash, and they go into this cult kind of context, okay? That's what we think about cult. When you're in Old Testament studies, you can't think like that, okay? Old Testament studies, the cult is anything you do externally to symbolize your religion. Anything you do externally to symbolize your religion. So, for example, when we prayed before class, question, did I bow my head and close my eyes to pray? I bowed my head. Is that part of the cult? Yes. That's part of the cult. That's something I do externally. When someone prays, does some people take off their hats when they pray? okay, to show respect and things like that. And so different people do. Does anybody do this? You know what I'm saying? Cross themselves. Is that some of the? Is that an external act of worship that you do to symbolize? Okay, those are external things. Some of you come from churches that do a lot with the cult in terms of external things, like liturgy. Okay, do some of you come from churches that have a lot of liturgy, and do others of you come from churches that have almost no liturgy? Okay, and so you get into different things, traditions and things like that. Anything you do externally to symbolize your religion. By the way, will some people symbolize their religion externally by wearing a t-shirt? I'm in Greek class and a kid says, you know, Jesus rules on his t-shirt or something like that. Is that an external expression of his religion? So you could say anything that you do externally, liturgy, typically in churches and things like that with the cult. Is there a lot of external expression of religion in the Old Testament? Is there a lot of external expression in the Old Testament? Yeah, they had to think about how they approached God in various ways. So the importance of externals as you approach God. Do externals matter, or does only your heart matter? Do externals matter when you approach someone? Do externals matter when you approach someone? Now, I'll use a ritual. I call it a torture ritual I have with my wife. I probably shouldn't say it like that, but okay. You have to understand, my background is I grew up playing athletics, okay? I played athletics since I was a kid. And so, you know, in high school, I played soccer, basketball, tennis, 3 seasons, 3 different sports when I went to college. Played 2 different seasons, basketball and tennis and stuff in college and stuff. So how should I say, have I been working out? I don't work out anymore. It's obvious. But anyways, but when I was younger, did I work out like every day? Sweat part of my life. You know what I'm saying? I worked out all the time and stuff and was athletic and things like that. So does sweat bother me? And the answer is no. I've been sweaty half my life, but okay. So then now all of a sudden I find myself married. So I'm out cutting the lawn and I'm cutting the lawn and then I do the weeding and I'm doing all this work outside and stuff. And I come in and I got a t-shirt on and stuff. And so I'm drenched with sweat and stuff. And then I have this ritual that I come up to my wife and I say, honey, do you love me? How much do you love me? I want a hug. And I come and I use it to check how much she loves me. Now the question is, does she love me or love me not? Okay, when you're sweaty like that, love me not, okay, and stuff. But what I'm saying is, okay, what happens? How come when I approach my wife and I'm all sweaty like that question, does approach matter? Does approach matter? Does that affect how she thinks about me? Does approach matter? When I'm all sweaty and stuff, is that gross to her? And she says what? Get away from me, get away from me. Okay, I said, that's all, my wife doesn't love me anymore, stuff like that. Oh, it's time to take a shower, buddy. You got to get your act together. So anyways, what I'm saying is approach matters. Approach matters. How does that affect how we approach God? How does that affect how we approach God? The other day, I was in my office. Usually when I study in my office, I kick back in my chair and I put my feet up on my desk and I read. Okay, that's how I read. Okay, I kick back, put my feet up on my desk and I read. All of a sudden, I hear a knock at the door. And I turn around. This is the third floor of Frost. Well, the faculty are up there. Nobody goes up there but faculty, okay? Nobody can find their way up there. It's a maze and stuff. So we're up there. And all of a sudden, I turn around, and honk, there's the president of Gordon College. I'm kicking back my feet up on my desk. I go, holy cow, here's the president. Now, question, did I feel a little bit embarrassed about that? This is the president of the college, okay? Do I want to be sitting there with my feet up on my desk when the president of the college stops by? Okay, I just never saw the president in 12 years. I've never seen a president up there. Do I like this guy's really go-getter? And he's up in my office. I'm like, all of a sudden it's like, whoa, okay. I used to have a president up here and things like that. And we had a great conversation and stuff. He's a good, really good guy. But what I'm saying is, question, president shows, okay, now suppose Elaine Phillips, who I've known for 35 years, is a good friend. Elaine pops over and I got my feet up on my desk. Is that a big deal? No, she knows me and stuff like that. It's no problem. Question, president shows up, big deal? Big deal, okay? So question, does it matter the stature of the person on how you approach? Does it matter the stature? Do you approach your friends the same way you would approach somebody who's, you know, your boss or somebody that's very significant? Would you approach the president of the United States? Would there be a sense of you know, he's the president of the United States, so a sense of respect and that kind of thing. So what I'm saying is, as you approach God, are there certain things God says that are repulsive to him, and are there certain things that God likes? Actually, I'm referring to Psalm 15. Does God like gossipers? No, he doesn't, okay? So you gossip and come to God, God says, I don't like that, okay? Does God like people that are righteous, that are kind, that are just, that are fair, that are compassionate to the poor? Yes, those people God likes, and you know what I'm saying? So this whole, the book of Leviticus then describes how one approaches a holy God. How one approaches a holy God. And there are certain things that are an abomination to him, that are offensive to him, that are disgusting to him. And it's like coming to him with a soaking wet, you know, t-shirt and asking for a hug. It's just, it's not appropriate at that point because you're coming the wrong way. So anyways, this approach, the book of Leviticus describes this approach. Now, here's another way to look at pretty much the same thing. What in life is secular? Okay, my car's low on gas. I'm going to go buy some gas on the way home probably or tomorrow morning. Question, when I go to buy gas, is that secular or sacred? Well, it's impoverishing, that's what it is, but it, okay. Is it secular or sacred, okay? When I go to the gas station, it's a secular thing, okay? I'm gonna go up to Sam's Club probably this weekend and buy some food and stuff for, you know, things. My son's coming back and he eats like a horse, so I gotta buy all this food and stuff. When I go up to Sam's Club and stuff, is that secular or sacred? That's, you know, again, secular thing. I go out shopping and, you know, get all this food and stuff, bring it home and things. So those are secular. What would be sacred? Would like going to church, would that be more sacred? Reading my Bible and praying, would those be more like sacred things? Okay. I said, well, my question is, when my wife goes shopping, is that secular or sacred?
Sacred.
Yeah. Actually, it turns out many of you answered the question. And as a guy, you just got to get used to that. That's sacred time, okay? When shopping is like, anyways, okay. But anyways, sacred. Sacred. Going to church, reading your Bible, praying, those types of things are considered sacred. What the book of Leviticus tells us is, and this is a big message of the book of Leviticus, and this is a very important message and stuff. Basically, the book of Leviticus tells us that a whole of a person's life, everything we do is sacred. Everything we do is sacred. When the Jewish people sit down to eat, did they have to think about God in the types of food that they eat? Yes. When an Israeli woman has a child, does she have to think about God in the having of that child and how many days she's unclean for? As a matter of fact, even when the Israeli people, when they're in the desert and they go to relieve themselves, when they go to relieve themselves, do they have to think about God? Can they relieve themselves anywhere? Did God tell them that they have to relieve themselves outside the camp and they have to bury it? Yeah. So all of life is sacred. One of the great sayings of Dr. Wilson here is, study, how many of you see your studies as sacred? Is it possible to study or do your studies as something that's totally secular? Can calculus be made sacred? Okay. What Dr. Wilson says this, is study is the highest form of worship. In other words, what he's saying is, take your studies. Can you offer your studies up to God? Can you take your studies, even your study of mathematics or biology, chemistry, physics, whatever, literature, whatever, you offer it up to God so that all of life and study is the highest form of worship, and use those types of things. So a whole of that's the message of Leviticus. Everything is specified. Everything is sacred. There's no secular, sacred distinction in this. Leviticus says that which is secular and sacred, they're one. All of life is sacred and lived out in the presence of God. Now, what does holiness mean? This is the key verse in the book of Leviticus. You may be vaguely familiar with this verse. Okay? Be holy because I, the Lord, notice how this is spelled, capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D. What's the Hebrew term behind this? This is Jehovah or Yahweh. See how it's all capitalized? So this is the term for God. Because I am the Lord your God. I am Yahweh. I am Yahweh. I am Jehovah your God. God would be what? The Hebrew word Elohim or El or Elohim. So this will be God will be El or Elohim. This will be Yahweh. God's most precious name. He says, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. So you are to be holy because God is holy. We are to reflect his holiness. Now, 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 15 in the New Testament echoes the same thing. So in other words, this isn't just an Old Testament concept. 1 Peter says the same thing, be holy. So we as Christians are to be holy because the Lord our God is holy. So Peter, same type of thing. Now, what does it mean to be holy? The root idea of holiness, I like this phrase here, totally other. What holiness or kadosh means is that God is totally other, that God is totally different than anything you've ever experienced. God is different. He's totally other. He's totally different than anything you've ever experienced in your life. By the way, what does that tell us? When we meet God, when we actually meet God, are we all going to be shocked? When we meet God, are we all going to meet the totally other? In other words, there's nothing in this world that's like God. He's totally different. All our imaginations, all our wonderings and stuff like that, God is different than anything we can imagine. And when we meet God, it's basically he's totally other. The idea of holiness means this idea of separateness. He's different. He's separate. He's separate from the rest of creation. There's nothing like him. He's separate. He's distinct from creation. God is totally unique. He's totally unique. There's only sui generis. He's only one of a kind. There's only one like him in the whole universe. He's special. That may be another way to say holiness, is say he's special. Holiness is making something special, something separate, distinct, unique, something that's special. Isaiah says it this way. By the way, the book of Isaiah also has a lot on the book concept of holiness. Isaiah says this, to whom will you compare me? Now, first of all, what kind of question is that? Is he expecting an answer to that question? To whom will you compare me? What's the answer? Is he asking a cognitive answer? Is that a rhetorical question? Does a rhetorical question expect an answer? No. Okay. And so what he's doing is here, he's making a rhetorical question is a statement in the dress of a question. A rhetorical question is a statement in the dress of a question. What he's trying to say here, what is he trying to say by this? To whom will you compare me? What is he trying to say? What's the statement that he's making there? There is no one like God. Micaiah. There is no one who is like God. Micaiah. There is no one like God. So the statement here, to whom will you compare me, is there is nothing you can compare. There is no one you can compare God to. Or who is my equal? God has no equal. Says the Holy One. Says the Holy One. The incomparability, Old Testament scholars call this the incomparability of Yahweh. Okay, the incomparability of Yahweh, he is totally different than anything. There's nothing we can compare him to. It's totally different. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Okay. You need to keep some ideas. Now, I thought you were going to come the other way. Some people say, well, we can know something about God because we're made in God's image, so therefore we know something about God. Okay, well, we got to put that aside and say, yes, God is love. Do we know how to love? Yes, we know how to love. Okay, do we know compassion? Yes, okay. Do we know justice, righteousness, those types of things? We have ideas of those things. But what this is saying is go beyond that. In other words, those categories are, how should I say, those things don't describe God who is beyond all those things. And so the holiness thing is about the beyondness of it. And it's not saying there's totally no connections. In other words, when you read a statement like this, he's not saying, because we're made in his image. So there are things that we are similar to God. And I think that's what Lewis is referring to there. But there's another sense in which, while we're similar to God in some ways, there's other ways. He's beyond anything we've ever experienced in life. And so the holiness points out that beyondness, okay? And so the holiness focuses on that beyondness, that or that otherness, would be another way to say it, the otherness of it. So, beautiful verse there in Isaiah. Here's another one from Isaiah about this idea of separateness. God is separate. He's distinct from everything. Separateness. But does separateness mean remoteness? Does separateness mean remoteness? Check this verse out from Isaiah 57:15. This is a beautiful verse. It says, for this is what the high and lofty one says. So God calls himself, this is what the high and lofty one says. He's high, he's lofty, he's out there kind of thing. This is what the high and lofty one says. He who lives forever. In other words, this, you know, eternity, both directions. He lives forever. Whose name is what? Holy. Okay, and that's the focus here. Whose name is holy. He's totally different. He lives forever. He's high and lofty one. He lives forever. His name is holy. He says, I live in the high and holy place. The holy place is where God lives. He lives. He himself is holy. His name is holy. And he lives in a holy, a special place. A place set apart, separate, special, unique. He says, I live in this holy place. And so you get this image of this guy, high, lifted up, holy and stuff. And then the verse turns with this but here. It's beautiful. He says, okay, this high and holy God, who does he live with? Who does God live with? But also with him who is contrite and lowly in spirit. What's contrite mean? It means the broken ones. Who does God live with? The high and lofty God, the holy one who's separate, lives in this special holy place. He lives with the broken ones. Do you see the turn, how that turns? You get this holy God, rather than living with all these really, you know, holy, he lives with people that are broken, the contrite, the lowly in spirit. Now, by the way, what does our culture tell us? Do you have to promote yourself? You got to be confident in yourself. You got to promote yourself. You got to brand yourself. You got to, you know, yourself, yourself, yourself kind of thing. With whom does God live? With the lowly in spirit? With the humble? The humble? With the broken ones, the broken ones. This is beautiful to see, you know. So God's holiness, does it mean that he's remote? The answer is no. No, God lives with the broken ones. And this, I love the way this verse just shifts from this high and lofty one to those that are lowly as to whom he lives. This is a beautiful verse. Isaiah. Now, what about holiness? Does holiness mean that we should be afraid of him? Does holiness mean that we should be afraid of God? And when God's holiness comes, is there like this fear that comes? By the way, what does the Bible say? The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. But how many of us have been taught that the fear of God doesn't really mean fear of God? It means that you reverence God. God is awesome. And the fear of God doesn't really mean fear. It means reverence. And I just want to tell you that the fear of God means the fear of God. The fear of God, okay? The terror of God. Now, by the way, does the notion of the fear of God also mean reverence and respect? Yes, it does. And it also means obedience and things. And actually, I've worked on that concept. I actually just did a paper last November on the fear of God and things. And so it's an interesting concept. Part of the fear of God is this notion of fear. How many of you fear... Are there certain individuals that cause fear? You're traveling down the road. All of a sudden, the man pulls up in back of you. He's got a set of lights across the top of his car, and you have no clue how fast you're going. Question, fear? Okay. I experienced this last weekend. My son was flying out from Logan Airport out to Denver to visit my other son, and they're going to go elk hunting, okay? And so I have a gun called a 30-06, and it's in a case. And so my son and I went down. We took him down. It was, I don't know, 9. His plane was at 9:20, so we were down there about 8:30 or so. And so my son and I walk up, and I take my gun case and stuff and stuff. He's going to go out, and so he has a gun from my other son in Denver, who scoped out all the elk and all that kind of stuff. So we put the gun case on. They're going to, check luggage, right? So it's going to go through. Apparently, you have to declare that you're flying with the gun. And I didn't, to be honest with you, I didn't know the laws. And my son didn't know the laws either. And so they took the gun case and things, and then my wife and I went home. And so he was supposed to be getting on this airplane and stuff. All of a sudden, about 9 o'clock, we get this phone call from my son saying, Dad, how do you get this case open? They want me to open this case. I said, what do you mean open this case? He said they pulled him aside. Just before he's supposed to fly out, they pulled him aside and forced him to open the case. I said, well, I gave you the key to it and stuff. He says, yeah, but the key won't work. So I told him how it's this special thing. You got a monkey with a key. So I got a monkey with a key. So he says, okay, I got it. So then he hangs up and stuff. About 10 minutes later, he calls up again. He says, okay, now how do I lock this thing? And I says, okay, well, you go back. You got to get in the right way. And yeah, you got to feel it a little bit. And I said, don't snap the key or you're done and stuff. So then he calls back. Meanwhile, my wife is freaking because she realizes he's got pulled aside. For flying with a weapon without declaring it is a federal felony. My wife is freaking out and she's getting like sobbing and sobbing and sobbing. And it's like, I can't believe you let him go without that. You didn't tell your son what you did. I said, I didn't know you're supposed to declare it. Meanwhile, my other son calls up and he starts screaming. He never screamed at me in life. He says, Dan, I can't believe you're, anyways. And he goes off on me and says, you better get your tail down there. Your son is being hauled off to jail right now, and he's going to need your help. You better get back down there. And I said, oh, okay, I better get back down there. Meanwhile, Zach then calls my sister, my daughter, who's married to a top lawyer, and my son-in-law now, who's a lawyer, tells Zach that he knew a friend that carried on a thing without declaring as well, and he was put in prison for 2 years. And the guy that was put in prison was a lawyer. So now all of a sudden we jump in the car, we're going down there, and Robert's calling, he's got a good lawyer friend in Boston, and this is like 11 o'clock at night, and he's saying, this is going to cost you thousands of dollars, and you still may end up in jail, because I'm not sure I can get this done. So he's calling up his lawyer friend, we're going down there. Question, was there fear in me? I'm going down there realizing it's my gun. Is it possible Gordon College Prof sits in jail for unauthorized weapon to his son and stuff? And I said, man, I prayed for this kid for like 7 months when he was over in Afghanistan. He was getting shot at every day. God brings him back to America. And when he gets back in America, they put him in jail. You know. So anyways, I'm freaking out and going down. But question, was there fear? Now what question? Was there fear of the law, of a police? Have you guys ever had a fear of a police? Okay, yeah, so there was real fear. Now you say, that doesn't mean that life with God. Police can put me in jail. Does God have power to do other things beyond that? Okay, and so all I'm saying is, yeah. And so the fear of God, you need to think about that. I know we're in a no-fear culture kind of thing, but what I'm saying is, you need to think about that. And by the way, my son got, I actually met the guy that interviewed my son. I came down there. I said, excuse me, can anybody tell me here whether Elliot Hildebrandt got put on a plane and stuff? And the guy was going to punch it in the machine. There was another guy kicked back in the thing. He says, yeah, he's on his plane. So then I said, how do you know? How do you know him? I said, would you memorize all the people on the list of the plane or something? And I was just joking around with the guy because I wanted to make light of this because it was real serious. The guy says, no. He says, I only know the names of those guys that are trying to carry on firearms. And I said, okay. So I was back to, did he talk his way out of it? Apparently he talked his way out of it and the guy gave him a break and so he didn't report him because otherwise it would have been real serious. So question, as a parent, yeah, I know never to do that again. Anyways, okay. So anyways, okay. Fear and dread of God. Fear of dread of God. Isaiah is standing before God, and God is up in the heavens, and these angels are winging around God saying what? Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. Isaiah looks at a holy God, seeing these seraphim, cherubim type things going around with six wings flapping and saying, holy, holy, holy. And what happens? Isaiah feels what? I am a man of what? Unclean lips and dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. He feels his own shame in front of a presence of a holy God. God, the angel then takes a thing, a coal, puts it on his lips, burns and like purifies him and says, Isaiah, you're my man. And this is Isaiah 6 is the call of Isaiah where the angel says, and then God comes and basically says to Isaiah, you're going to speak for this holy God that you saw. You're going to speak for this holy God. You're going to be a prophet, Isaiah. And you're going to speak God's word. So a lot of the book of Isaiah is about holiness because Isaiah saw God in his holiness and then felt this kind of like tension between himself and God with his holiness kind of thing. Now, holiness in action. Holiness of God's holiness, then he is holy, he is special, he is unique. He moves to select and make a people holy. So God's holiness gets him, he selects a people, and he says here in Exodus chapter 9, verse 16, he says, you will be for me a kingdom of priests, the whole nation, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. Out of all the nations of the earth, Israel was special. out of all the nations of the earth, Israel was special. Israel was unique. Israel was separated, special to God. Special to God, a holy nation, separated from all the other nations of the earth. It is through that nation that God would send his son. And so God's holiness moves to select and make a people holy. Now, can we make something holy? Now, this is a little bit weird, but just follow me. Can we make something holy? And the answer is yes. Okay? Remember, the Ten Commandments tell us, remember the Sabbath day to do what? To keep it holy. How is the Sabbath day holy? Is the Sabbath day a special day? Are we supposed to reverence the Sabbath day to make it special? We don't do what on the Sabbath? Work. You're an Old Testament Jewish person, and you don't do that on the Sabbath. Okay? By the way, when is the Sabbath? When is the Sabbath? Okay? For the Jewish folks, Saturday. Okay? When does the Sabbath start? Okay? Friday night when the sun goes down. Friday night when the sun goes down. That's when Shabbat starts. Friday night when the sun goes down. Most Jewish families, when the sun goes down, the Jewish family will have Shabbat dinner as a family together. And that's when they'll celebrate as a family. They usually have Shabbat dinner. Friday night, as sun goes down, family has a dinner. They call it Shabbat dinner, okay, Shabbat Shalom kind of thing. That means you're saying goodbye on Friday, and it's basically Friday night. When does the Sabbath end? Goes Friday night when the sun goes down, it begins, and it goes till when? Sundown, Saturday night. What do the Jewish people do Saturday night after the sun goes down? They party, okay? The sun goes down, Shabbat is over. Saturday night, the sun goes down, everybody's out on the streets. If you're ever in Jerusalem, you go to Kikar Tzion and Jaffa Road, and you will see 10,000, at least 10,000 Jewish people swarming all over. Everybody's having a good time, and they're all out in the streets dancing, partying, and getting down, okay? And this is on Kikar Tzion, okay? They call it Zion Square and things. So anyways, so that's the Sabbath, okay? So Sabbath, you don't work. Saturday night, when the sun goes down, boom, then the lid's off, and they have fun, okay? Now, you can sanctify something. Does anybody do Latin? The first part of this, do you see this word sancta? Sancta? What's another sancta word that you know? Sancta is the Latin for holy. What's another sancta that you know? Sanctuary? Okay, if I said a sanctuary, is a sanctuary a holy place where we go to worship? Okay, a sanctuary. But by the way, let me just say this. What about a bird sanctuary? Have you ever heard of a bird sanctuary? Is a bird sanctuary a place that is special for birds? Yeah. So the idea of sanctuary being some special place for, in that case, birds, or sanctuary for the... Yeah, where are you going with sanctuary?
Not the sanctuary, but back to the Sabbath. If it's Saturday, then why do we do it on Sunday?
Okay. The Jewish folks do it on Saturday because that's the seventh day. It got moved to Sunday. Basically, the early Christians, they actually celebrated Sabbath because they were Jewish, okay? The apostles were all Jewish. Jesus was Jewish. They celebrate the Sabbath. When Jesus rose from the dead, they switched to celebrating that seventh day, or the special day, to celebrate the resurrection of Christ. There was also probably some tensions between Jewish folk and Christian folk, and so largely they moved it to Sunday because of the resurrection.
Continue on with Saturday.
Yeah, and some of the people would celebrate both Saturday and Sunday. Okay, but largely the resurrection, because the resurrection was on Sunday. The church moved our special day to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus. So, good question. Okay, so sanctify something means to set it apart. To set it apart is something special, and these are special things to make it holy. Now, what we want to do is say, how do you make something holy? And think, what types of things can be holy? What types of things can be holy? There's holy oil. Holy oil. Now, when the Bible says oil, what type of oil does it mean? I heard a preacher once get up and say, you know, Asher will dip its foot in oil, and that means that the tribe of Asher has oil underneath it, and they need to drill for the oil because the Bible says there's oil down there because it says oil, Asher will dip its foot in oil. Is that totally, like, bogus? Like, totally, absolutely crazy. There's other words for it, but it's totally crazy. Whenever the Bible refers to oil, it's not referring to, you know, 10-20 or 10-30 weight of oil. It's talking about olive oil. They do everything with olive oil. They cook with olive oil. They all sorts of stuff with olive oil, okay? And so olive oil, they take olives, they press them, it makes olive oil. They do everything over there with olive oil. By the way, it's really good on bread and things, but anyways, olive oil. But by the way, what do they do with oil too? Oil is like a holy substance. What do they do with the oil? They take the oil and they do what? They oil someone. That is, they put oil on someone's head. We call that what? Anointing. Now, what is the Hebrew term for taking oil? And what you're taking is this holy substance of oil, and you're designating somebody as holy. You're designating them as holy. What do we call that process of taking oil and putting it on someone's head? You say we call that anointing, but what's the Hebrew term for that? You all know it. I'll say it. It's called Mashiach. Mashiach. You oil someone. You oil someone is Mashiach. You Mashiach them. Okay? What's Mashiach? Can you hear the word? It's in English. Okay? Can you hear the word Mashiach? You a Mashiach? Yeah. It's the word Messiah. Messiah. The term Messiah, Mashiach, actually comes from... The Messiah is the oiled one. The Messiah is the oiled one, the anointed one. Okay? So, for example... Who was oiled in that culture? Would the priests be oiled, anointed with oil? Would the kings, does anybody remember Saul? You haven't read that part yet, but Saul and David were anointed with oil as kings of Israel. And so the kings would be anointed. So the Mashiach is the oiled one. Mashiach, Messiah. How does the oiled one come over into the New Testament? The New Testament's in Greek. You know what the Greek word for oiled is? Christos. Christos. Does anybody hear this? Jesus what?
Christ.
Jesus Christ. You thought it was his last name. No, Jesus Christ isn't his last name. It's Jesus the what? Jesus the anointed one. Jesus the Mashiach, the oiled one. So the oil is used when you want to make something holy, you anoint it with oil. And so oil is the special substance, okay? Oil is special substance here. Incense is another thing that's really pretty holy. They would burn incense in a really holy context, and the fragrance would fill the air, and there would be a special holy incense. So these are two things that were considered holy in various contexts and things. Now there's holy places. Holy places. You have, do you remember Moses walking up? Moses walks up, he sees this bush burning. So Moses says, whoa, look at that, man. This bush is burning. Daylight's out of itself there. He walks up and says, man, the bush isn't burning. So he walks up and he takes a look. And all of a sudden when he takes a step forward, what happens? The bush says what? Mission accomplished. Okay, what does the bush say? Okay, the bush says, take off your shoes. You're on holy ground. Take off your shoes. You're on holy ground. Okay? So was that place holy? Why was that place holy? It was a bush that was on fire. Why was that place holy? It was a special place. God's presence was there. Moses approaches, and what's the problem with the approach? You're getting too close. Take off your shoes. It's holy ground. Okay? And do some religions, even till this day, express their feeling of holiness by taking off their shoes? Yeah. Okay, so this holy ground there, the Holy of Holies. Now what does this mean, the Holy of Holies? If I said to you the Song of Songs, what am I referring to? The Song of Songs? Song of Solomon, but it's called the Song of Songs. When the Jewish people say the Song of Songs, plural, what they mean is that this is the bestest song ever, okay? They mean it's a way of doing superlatives for them. The Song of Songs means the absolute best song. Okay, so when they say the Holy of Holies, what does this mean? This is the most holy place. This is, as that song is like the best song ever, this is the most holy place ever kind of thing. The Holy of Holies is the most sacred place. And so it's a way for them to say, you know, like the best, the most holy, the holiest kind of thing. Like we would use EST on the end of a word to make it the mostest. The temple. The Lord is in His holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before Him. The Lord is in His holy temple. Why is the temple holy? Because God's presence is there. And His presence then makes that place holy. Yeah, Sarah.
I was also supposed to talk about the holy place. I remember being learning that the sacrifice that was made,
yes.
And that they
Yeah. Yeah. So we're here. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Let me just narrate what she just said. That's exactly right. On the Day of Atonement, once a year, they would go into the Holy of Holies place. They were so afraid that if something happened to them, they basically would tie a rope around them and then a bell and stuff. And if they went down then, what the problem is, they went down because they weren't pure. The other priests go in, what happens to them? They go down too. So what happens, they put a rope on him so that if he goes down and stuff, they can pull him out and so that it won't be for the Holy of Holies. That was in the time of, around the time of Christ, Josephus and some of the other people mentioned that kind of thing. But yeah, so this is the Holy of Holies. Now what we have so far here, we've had the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle where they move in this tent that we've looked at, and eventually will the Holy of Holies come to reside in the temple, and you'll have behind the veil there of the temple and stuff. By the way, you also have the Holy Mountain. What is the Holy Mountain? What is the name of the mountain that's considered? When God says, my holy mountain, what mountain is that? Zion, okay, Mount Zion. Has anybody ever heard of that? Mount Zion, which is in Jerusalem, the Temple Mount. Okay, God calls it my holy mountain. By the way, well, let me just do another one just out of my head. Do you guys remember Mount Sinai? You guys have read Exodus 32. Remember the mountain shaking and stuff? God's presence was on the mountain. The people were told, were they allowed on that mountain or were they told to stay off of it? Yeah, the whole mountain became holy. God's presence was there. Moses gets to go up. The people stay off the mountain. Okay, and the animals were supposed to stay off the mountain too. So God's presence in a place as being holy. By the way, have some of you experienced places that are special places to you where you've kind of met God and they're special places? And I want to call those as holy places, okay? Places, special places where you've met God. And anyway, so just you need to think about that. Different places, different things that are holy. And then here are some other things that are holy. If you say this fast three times, what do you get? Holy days becomes what? Holidays. This is what we call holidays. The Y changes to an I. By the way, is Y changing to an I is no big deal linguistically. And it's our holidays, holy days, okay? And what's a holy day? It's the Sabbath. The Sabbath, as we said, they celebrate on Friday night, begins the Sabbath. They have family dinner, and then they celebrate the Sabbath with no work. And then Saturday night, the Sabbath ends. The Bible says, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Okay, so the Sabbath, big important point. The feasts. The feasts. The Jews will have a series of feasts. And by the way, will the feasts be listed in Leviticus? Are the feasts going to be important for the priests? Do the priests have to officiate at the feasts? Yeah, so the book of Leviticus is going to go through the feasts in detail because, you know, the priests and Levites, that's what the priests officiate at, these feasts. And that'll be Leviticus chapter 23. So these are holy days. So are there special times? Are there holy times? Do some of you have special times that you meet with God? And so I'm saying this, the time, and then we looked at space. So the time and space are experienced in the presence of God. And that time and that space become holy. Okay? When a person experiences in that time, that place, these kind of holy things. Now, what happens when holy things are violated? What happens when holy things are violated? Do you remember these two guys? Nadab and Abihu. Nadab and Abihu. Whose kids were these? Yeah, these are Aaron's two sons. Did they offer up in an authorized, in Leviticus chapter 10, they offer in an authorized fire before the Lord. They offer in an authorized fire from the Lord. What happens to them? They get consumed and they're destroyed. They're dead, okay? So these two guys, Aaron's kids, offer in an authorized fire. They are smitten dead in the presence of the Lord. They violate the holiness of God and the holiness of God consumes them. By the way, do you think that affected Aaron very much? Okay, when Aaron goes in there, do you think Aaron went trouncing in there and say, hey, well, I'm here now, I'm the high priest, man, so, hey, these kids, they didn't know what they were doing, so I'm here now. You think Aaron went in like that? Or would Aaron go, whoa, okay, do you see the change of attitude that would have happened? Okay, these were Aaron's kids, too. It's kind of interesting, too. In our culture, do we always get a second chance? In our culture, do we always get a second chance and always the consequences never really come to bear on us because somebody will bail us out and stuff like that? Did the consequences fall on these kids? No second chance. Okay. I think you need to think about that. Consequences happen and stuff, and you just it's not always, how should I say, God doesn't always move with this grace and compassion and long-suffering that means there's no consequences to anything. It's pretty strong here with Nadab and Abihu, Leviticus chapter 10. Here's another one that's also difficult. This one was difficult for David, King David. What was David doing here? This guy's name is Uzzah. David, the Ark of God had been out with the Philistines. And the Ark had been going from place to place with the Philistines. The Philistines, finally, they're getting killed, so they said, we got to give this Ark back to the Jews. So the Ark comes back into the Jewish territory. David then makes Jerusalem his capital. David makes Jerusalem his capital, and he wants to bring the Ark of God up to his political capital. So then Jerusalem would be the religious capital as well as the political capital. And so David captured Jerusalem. It was owned by the Jebusites before. David was the one who captured Jerusalem, and that's why it's called the city of whom? The city of David, because David is the one who captured Jerusalem. So David now is trying to bring the Ark up to Jerusalem. They put it on a cart. The cart's going up. It's kind of like New England. There's rocks everywhere. And so what happens is the cart hits a rock or whatever, and the Ark is going to fly off this thing. What's Uzzah do? Uzzah puts out his hands to stabilize the Ark. He touches the Ark. What's the problem when you touch the Ark? Boom. He's dead. Okay? He touches the Ark. He's dead. Okay? You guys all know it from Indiana Jones. You open up the Ark and what happens? Everybody's face melts down. Anyways, so the Ark. By the way, David, did that scare David? Did that scare David? What did David say? Okay, David's bringing the Ark up to Jerusalem, wanting to bring it up. All of a sudden, Uzzah, and he calls it Peretz Uzzah, the breaking forth on Uzzah. And David says, whoa, keep the Ark there. Keep the Ark there. And David then didn't bring the Ark up at that time. And then several years later, or whatever later time, I forget exactly how long it was, David goes down. Next time he brings it up, do they bring it up on the priest's shoulders, carrying it up, offering sacrifices every 7 steps all the way up to Jerusalem? Okay? And then David dancing before the Lord with all his might. We'll get into that later. But this bringing of the Ark of the Lord to this Uzzah violated the holiness of God. He dies. Here's one you're probably not aware of. This guy is King Uzziah. King Uzziah from 2 Chronicles 26. Uzziah was thinking he was big stuff. And so Uzziah is the king. And he's going to show everybody he's the big king. So he says, hey, I'm going to go offer incense by myself. I don't need a priest. I can go do it myself. So Uzzah's going in there, Uzziah's going in there, he says, I'm going to offer up the incense myself. I don't need these priests. The priests go, Uzziah, don't do it. Don't do it, Uzziah. Don't do it. Back off, Uzziah. I said, I'm the king. I'm going in there. He goes in there and goes to do the incense thing, and what happens to his hand? All of a sudden, zoom, the guy gets leprosy, and he's covered with leprosy. What, by the way, when you got leprosy, are you clean or unclean? Unclean. And so all of a sudden, then the priests just rush him out of there. And by the way, Uzziah then has leprosy for the rest of his life and lives as a leper the rest of his life for violating, again, that holy space, violating that holy space and that holy place with God. So these are three examples of people violating that holiness and kind of the response that you get there. Now, how are things made holy? How are things made holy? Things are designated, or what they call sanctified. Sancta is the Latin word for holy. Sancta is the Latin word. This is sanctuary. Has anybody ever heard of the study of sanctification? What is the study of sanctification? The study of being made holy. By the way, is anybody in the holiness movement? My day, they used to have the holy rollers. They used to have, anyways, holiness. It is sanctified, that which is made holy. So sanctified, you basically set apart something for a special purpose. You set something apart for a special purpose. You sanctify it. You designate it, oftentimes with oil and that kind of thing. And how does the transmission go? The transmission goes usually through touch. You anoint some with oil. Has anybody ever heard the phrase laying on of hands? Okay? When you're designating a minister or an elder in your church that says they, or a missionary, have any guys done that with the missionaries? And they come up and they lay hands on you? And it's supposed to be this laying out of hands through touch. You're designating this person to be a special person who's going to be a missionary to a special place. And you designate that person as being special, dedicated to that cause. And so usually it's through touch, and usually it's through oil. The holiness is usually touch and oil, anointed. You anoint the person, you touch the altar, and it's, the altar is holy and things like that. Now, here's a really cool story with Jesus, okay? Matthew chapter 9, verse 20, and this also occurs in some of the other Gospels. Jesus is walking through a crowd, okay? Jesus is always walking through a crowd, okay? So Jesus is walking through a crowd. There's all these crowds around Jesus all the time. Feed me, you know? Anyways, all these crowds around Jesus. Sorry for that, was sarcastic, but anyways. So these crowds around Jesus, okay? Question, when you get in a crowd like that, do people push people, you know, touch people and things like that? I mean, we went to a basketball game down at the Celtics there, and, you know, the guys come out running out there and stuff like that. There was one guy that was there. Question, was everybody trying to touch him? Everybody was trying to touch him. This hand touched him. This hand touched him. I had Michael Jordan's sweat on my hand. I would never wash that hut. This is the honest truth. I did. My son made me do it. But anyways, he went over there. He's like, anyways, we did Michael, and boom, I got him. And Michael Jordan, I'll never wash that hand again, you know. Anyways, I do wash that hand. Anyways, but anyways, sorry. Anyways, but what I'm saying is this notion of this, okay, so Jesus is in a crowd. Everybody's pushing Jesus and stuff. Jesus stops in the crowd. And he says, hey, who touched me? Who touched me? The disciples say, come on, Jesus, what do you got all these people around you? Who touched me? You know, Jesus, who touched me? You know, what are you going to do? There's hundreds of people pushing you, touching you. Jesus says, no, somebody touched me. A question. Okay, you can see the disciples, you know, sometimes they just didn't understand the guy. So he turns around, question, somebody touched him. Did something happen? Something happened. He turns around, and there's a woman behind him. Question, the woman's got an issue of blood. Now, you've read Leviticus. You've read Leviticus. There's a woman there who's got an issue of blood. Question, is she clean or unclean? She's unclean. What happens when somebody's got leprosy who's unclean touches somebody who's clean? What happens to the person that's clean? Okay, you got leprosy, you touch a clean person. Question, is that person unclean until eating and got a wash and all this kind of stuff? Yeah, okay. So when unclean touches clean, what happens to the clean? The clean becomes unclean. What happens with Jesus? The woman touches Jesus. Question, does Jesus become unclean? No. It backfires, and boom, the woman becomes clean. Boom, she's healed. Is that cool? Does that totally violate Leviticus? Do you see what happens? Is all that Leviticus stuff there? Is she unclean? She's unclean. She touches Jesus. All of a sudden, boom, she is healed. Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. Okay, so you get this really cool stuff happening with Leviticus with Jesus, who touched me, and then flipping it back. Yes?
I heard, couldn't she have also been killed?
Well, yeah, she could have been killed. Is it possible with Jesus being holy and stuff, touching Jesus and her being unclean?
No, yeah. Could have. I mean, in the time, she knew that could have happened.
Yeah.
That was one of the risks.
Yeah, probably one of the risks and stuff to know. My guess is, too, though, Jesus is getting pushed around by everybody in the crowd and stuff, so it probably wasn't that high on the priority list. And she was hoping that Jesus would heal her, and that's actually exactly what happened. So. And when you're like that, it's probably worth the risk, you know, because, yeah. So anyways, that's a beautiful story with Jesus and Leviticus in the background of that story. Now, actually, before we do this, this next chart, I love this next chart. It's one of my favorite charts. Like, of all the stuff we do in PowerPoint, this is one of my favorite. This one chart has, like, the whole book of Leviticus. I'll never forget. I was teaching this whole course on Leviticus, and I stole this chart off of was Gordon Wenham. In his commentary on Leviticus. And when I saw the chart, it was like the whole book of Leviticus just flashed through my head. This one chart's got the whole book of Leviticus in it, okay? And it's, I don't know, this is a really cool chart. Sorry for overstating it, but this explains the whole book of Leviticus, okay? It's an overstatement, hyperbole, but anyways. You have three different states. You have the state of being holy, you have the state of being clean, and you have the state of being unclean. The woman with the issue of blood, she was what? She was unclean, okay? You got clean, and then you got holy. Now, much of the book of Leviticus, does it tell you about who's unclean A woman has a child and she's unclean for 33 days after having a child and she needs to do purification and stuff like that. A guy does certain things and he touches things he shouldn't and he's unclean. He's got to wash up, things like that. If you're unclean, how do you get to clean? If you're unclean, you cleanse. What substance do you use for cleansing? Water. Okay, water, largely, you wash up. Okay, so unclean, you clean, you wash. By the way, do the Jews have a ton of ceremonies where they're washing their hands? Ton of Jewish ceremonies where they're washing their hands. By the way, is that good hygiene, by the way, too? Yeah, okay, but just, okay, so they're washing their hands with this stuff. The other substance they can cleanse, but they don't wash in this, is blood. Okay, does blood cleanse and things? So would you have sacrifices taking you this way with the blood shed for the sacrifices? So water, blood, cleanse, okay, you become clean. Now, how do you move from clean to holy? How do you move from clean to holy? From moving from clean, you sanctify. What substance is usually used for sanctifying? Oil, olive oil. Okay, usually use oil, olive oil, for sanctifying, usually anoint and touching. Okay, so you basically use oil, touching, and then boom, it's made holy. A lot of the book of Leviticus is about this movement. Then what happens when something is holy? It goes the other way. When something is holy, you can profane that which is holy. You can defile or profane that which is holy, and it goes down this direction. When you've got something that's clean, you pollute it, and it becomes unclean. Okay? So you go down this direction, coming the other way. Is much of the book of Leviticus telling you these three states and the movement between these three states? Yeah, this is I don't know, man. This is like the book of Leviticus in just one chart like that. And it's a lot of stuff there. Yeah. Pardon? Yeah, that's why you had to listen very carefully to what I said. When you hit holy here and you profane it, it moves in this direction. And actually, it doesn't move directly to clean. It actually moves off the chart when you profane stuff. And the same thing here, when you pollute something that's clean, it kind of moves down right off the chart. So you got to be careful. On the coming up, they work very specifically coming up, but going back down, you're exactly right. It just, you know, it's like you're on a slippery slope here and you just shoom, down. It's bad to profane stuff, okay? Good observation. Now, purity laws. Why is a pig unclean? Okay. Why is a catfish unclean? When I was growing up, did we eat catfish? Did any of you eat ham? Okay, bacon. Okay, so catfish. Why is a catfish unclean? Okay. Why is a woman, now this is a little trickier, why is a woman unclean after childbirth? A woman after childbirth, isn't childbirth a natural process? Childbirth approved of God? Approved of God, natural process. Why is a woman after childbirth, why is she considered unclean? Here's another one. A married couple after having relations is considered unclean. A married couple, by the way, did God ordain that right from the beginning? Yeah. Yeah, God, you know, a man and wife, they become one flesh. I mean, you know, it's pretty obvious. Okay. So here, married couple, after every relations is unclean. So how do you think about this thing with this uncleanness type of thing, and how are we to understand it? Do you see the differences in these things? So I want to kind of explore different rationale for that and these purity laws. By the way, is this really foreign to our culture? Okay, and so what we're doing is moving to another culture, and we're moving back 3,000 years. And so in some sense, you got to kind of get out of the American, the way we think about things. They think about things very differently back then. And here's another one. Why was a priest with a deformed hand not allowed to serve? If a priest had a deformed hand, I've got a good friend, Floyd Vauta, and he's a librarian friend of mine, and he's got a deformed hand like this. Would he be allowed to serve as a priest? He couldn't serve as a priest. You say, well, that's discrimination against the handicapped, you know? That's not the, you know, you totally missed the point of the book of Leviticus, okay? So anyways, priests with deformed hands. So how do you make sense out of all these things? And so that's chapter 21, verse 5 and 17 and other places. So let me try to tackle that now. So let's Some people say that these purity laws are totally arbitrary, that God just said it, do this because I said so. By the way, have your parents ever told you to do something just because I said so? Okay. Is God totally arbitrary, though?
No.
Yeah, so that doesn't usually, it doesn't usually work real well. So this, God being totally arbitrary doesn't really fit his character. He usually does stuff for a purpose and things. So this one I find the weakest of the arguments. To be honest with you, I'd throw that out. I don't, just doesn't match God's character. He doesn't ask people to do things just totally arbitrarily. It seems always as connected with his character or his destiny or something, goals like character. Here's an explanation, cultic or cultural, that God is saying, hey, you guys, I want you guys to be different than the Canaanites. I want you to be different than the Canaanites. The Canaanites, when they build an altar, what do they build their altars out of? Cut stone. The Canaanites, when they do it, they cut and they cut their stone so that it's the stones fit together and they build their altars out of cut stone. God says, I don't want you to build your altar like that. I want you to build an altar out of uncut stones. Now, by the way, when we go back 3,000 years, can we tell a Jewish altar versus a Canaanite altar? Can we tell immediately? Yeah, a Canaanite altar is made out of cut stone down at a place called Arad, for example. You see a Canaanite altar, cut stone. And the Jewish altars are made out of uncut stone. At least some of them. Anyways, the Jews actually did make some out of cut stone and stuff. They weren't supposed to, but they did. So anyways, so in other words, the Canaanite culture does it this way, God says. I don't want you to do it that way. I want you to do it different so that there's a difference between your culture and Canaanite culture. And some of the laws seem to be explained by this difference in culture. So this does explain some stuff. The difference in culture between the Canaanite culture and the Israeli culture does seem to explain some things. Now, here's another one, the hygienics. There was a guy in the 1950s named McMillan who wrote a book called None of These Diseases. And what he did was he was a medical doctor. And as a medical doctor, he went through the book of Leviticus and he just said, is this stuff healthy? Now, by the way, did the Jews know anything about germs? The Jews had no clue about germs, okay? Absolutely no clue. Even the people in early America. Do you remember, has anybody been to Williamsburg and stuff, and how many people died because basically just basic health stuff, they didn't know about germs and stuff, and these people died, okay, and things. Hygienic thing. He goes through, by the way, the Jews, are they always washing their hands? Are they always washing their hands? Is that very healthy? That's very healthy, okay? You don't eat pig. You don't eat pork. Back in those days, did pork have trichinosis and things? And therefore, now, by the way, when you guys go to eat pork, does pork have trichinosis in America anymore? It's all been bred out. So you guys, to be honest with you, you don't have to worry about it. But back when I was growing up earlier, did you not leave pork sit out very long? Okay? Would you eat pork without cooking it? Now, today, it's probably, the trichinosis is not a problem and stuff. And actually, has anybody ever seen this guy that married my daughter and stuff eats hamburger. Has anybody ever seen somebody eat hamburger like without cooking it? They eat raw hamburger? No, I'm not kidding you. The guy eats raw hamburger and stuff. I don't know. I thought that was really weird and stuff. Cook your hamburger, please, and cook your stuff. But anyways, trichinosis with pork, okay, so he noticed that. By the way, a woman is unclean after childbirth. Should a woman get a break after childbirth? And this is the way they did it. For 33 days, a woman, is unclean after childbirth. And by the way, is that a healthy thing for her? Yes, it is. Okay, so many of the rules, let me just do this one. Okay, think about this in terms of bacteria and things. When you had to do your number, were you allowed to do your number? Were you allowed to go to the restroom inside the Jewish camp? No. The Bible says when you're inside the camp of Israel, you have the problem, you got to go. Basically, you have to go outside the camp and you have to bring a paddle with you to do what? Do you have to bury it outside the camp? Burying it outside the camp, is that healthy? Because if you did it inside the camp, would there be all sorts of flies and disease and all that kind of stuff? And God says, hey, no, when you do your number, do it outside the camp. Bury it outside the camp. Is that healthy? I mean, we still do it today. We call them septic tanks and things like that to this day. So what McMillan does is goes through and says, a lot of these rules are just downright healthy rules. A lot of them are downright healthy. But does that explain all of them? No, it doesn't. I'm going to propose another one now. This is actually built off a sociologist named Mary Douglas. And I've kind of adopted it as my own and made it my own stuff. But this one, this next one that I'm going to show you explain some of the really hard ones, the ones that I can't figure out and I have no clue on. And this is what I want to call the I call this the yuckiness view, okay? The yuckiness view. Does each culture have that which within the culture is yucky? Go back to a ritual with my wife. I like hamburgers. I like them with ketchup. I love ketchup. And so I put ketchup on both sides of the burger. I crunch into it, and then I get this ketchup thing going down here. And then I go to my wife and I say, "Do you love me? I would want to kiss. I want to kiss my gorgeous bride." And I've got ketchup coming down. And I know I've got ketchup coming down. And I want to see, "Do you love me? How much do you love me? Will you kiss me?" and stuff. Of course you won't. Get back from me. Anyway, get away from me. So go wipe your mouth. That kind of stuff. Okay? Question. When I approach her and I've got ketchup hanging down my mouth, question, is that yucky? Okay, let me use a different example. Okay, that's a bad example. Let me use a different example. Okay, I'm at a place called Grace College. There's a girl from another part of the world. In that part of the world, this is no joke, they eat spiders. So she's in the dorm, and there's a spider, and she pops it. Question. Yeah, okay, that. Does everybody see that? Is this that, is that question? That's yuckiness, okay? Now, by the way, did she see it as yucky? No. By the way, insects, is there good protein in insects? The honest truth is, yeah. She popped it and stuff. Everybody has got a gross smell, all that stuff. I think she was doing it partially for effect, but it just she popped it. So what I'm saying is yuckiness, different things in different cultures. And so let me just do this, okay? Let me do Dave Slusher, a friend of mine. Dave had a brain tumor, and the brain tumor was I was right behind his eye. He went to Cleveland Clinic, and they went into his head and pulled the tumor out. It was about the size of a golf ball. While they were in his head, they cut the there's a like a nerve that does your eyelid goes up and down on this nerve thing. They cut the nerve on one of his eyelids. So what happens is his eyelid came down, and it was like permanently down. So he could see through one eye, but his eyelid was down on the other side. Now what happens to your eye when your eyelid goes down after a period of time? Will your eye atrophies? And so basically he went blind in one eye, okay? So now he goes up. He goes up to people. When people come up to Dave, he's a very gregarious person. He's one of a wonderful conversationalist person, delightful guy, big guy. He comes up to people. Will he watch people's eyes to see when they do what? Yeah, question. He comes up to them. He'll talk with them. And he's watching their eyes the whole time. And will they look around and just be talking to him and stuff? And all of a sudden, will he see their eyes, boom, stare at that down eye? Yeah. Now, by the way, if he's talking with kids, will kids be really dramatic? And what has your parents ever told you, you don't stare at stuff like that? Okay. Now, question. So you come up to Dave, and he's got this bad eye, and all of a sudden you're going like, and I'll say, holy cow, look at that. All right. Now you're coming in to worship God. Does God want you staring at his eye, or does God want you thinking about him in worship? You come up, and a priest has got a deformed hand. You bring your sheep or goat up to offer a sacrifice. You got this priest who comes up with a deformed hand. What are you going to be watching? This one-armed priest taking down your sheep. I'm sorry, but are you going to see, how does this guy do this thing, man? He's got one arm taking the sheep down. Is everybody going to be thinking about how this guy's going to pull this off? I'm sorry, I'm not that weird. You guys think the same thing. You're just too polite. I know you guys are just all too classy for this stuff. But anyways, what I'm saying is, do you see how we take the focus off worship? That everybody would be thinking, how is this guy going to wrestle this sheep up there? And so therefore, God's saying, I don't want, let me put it another way. Let me use a different word from you. I don't want that which is non-normal. In other words, I want things to be normal so that when you come, there's nothing yucky. That when you come to my presence, everything is normal and you can focus on me. And that you're not distracted with this other stuff. So, for example, when you do your number, you don't do it in the camp. And all of a sudden, somebody's walking in the camp going to worship, and all of a sudden, and they start going, and they go to worship, and they get the stuff on their foot and stuff, and it smells, and they go, let's get out of here, thing kind of thing. God says, get out of the camp. When you come into my presence, I want you to be able to focus on me. So that's what's normal. Now, by the way, what is normal? Will that be different in different cultures? Will what's normal be different in different cultures? And so, that which is whole, God knows their culture, and he says, that which is whole, when you come before me, I want everything to be normal. I don't want anything to be like create dissonance when you're coming to worship me. So this yuckiness view, I think each culture does have these yucky things, and God's saying, don't do that when you're coming to worship and things. So I like this one because it explains some of the hard ones and just says some of the stuff, we just don't have the culture, we don't know the culture and stuff, but it seems that this is a cultural differentiation. Yeah,
so,
Eric.
So basically it's like, have these laws so that you're not really distracted.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so that the focus can be on God in an act of worship rather than on the particulars that are around. Now, how do we eat kosher? Let me just tell you, in the last class, Nate is actually Jewish, and so I don't know if anybody in here is Jewish or not, stuff like this. This is how you eat kosher. When you go to the grocery store, what do? You pick up the can, and you look for, it's got a circle with a K in it. It's got a K on the can, it's kosher. Okay? I'm joking, but not really. Okay? Do you guys know about the K on the can? Okay, yeah. So if it's K on the can, it's kosher and stuff. That's cool. Okay? So that's okay. Now, how do you eat real kosher? Land animals. How do you eat land animals kosher? There's two rules for land animals. Two rules for land animals. They got to do what? Split the hoof and chew the cud. Split the hoof, chew the cud. Okay? Split the hoof, chew the cud. Therefore, is beef good? Beef good? Sheep good? Goats good? Pigs are no good. Why? Split the hoof, but don't chew the cud. So pork is not. By the way, did pork have a problem with trichinosis, however, back in those days as well? So pork is out. You go to a Jewish person, you say, hey, let's go out for, let's get some ham and cheese. Okay? Now, just between the two of us, have I seen Jewish people eat pork? Yes, the answer is yes. Okay. You as a Gentile, should you offer them pork? Is that an insult? Once upon a time, remember I told you Saturday night go out and everybody's partying and stuff? Once upon a time I was out at Kikartzion in that area getting some pizza, okay? So we're going out, but stuff, we're going to get some pizza and stuff. There's all these people pushing and yelling their orders and the pizza order and things. And all of a sudden, somebody yells out, this is the honest truth, yells out, pepperoni pizza! And all of a sudden, all these people that are yelling, all of a sudden the whole place becomes like dead silent. Now, what's the problem? You saw my hair. I did have hair back in those days and stuff. Is it clear that I'm not Jewish? It's clear that I'm not Jewish. And everybody's looking around. Are they looking around for a Gentile? And like, I was a Gentile. And so question, is that the time you get out of there? And so it's all of a sudden you start backing up. You realize what's happened. I didn't do it. I mean, I'm not that dumb. I didn't do it. But they're looking around and I'm Gentile and stuff. So we just backed down. They took off as fast as we could because that's not cool. Okay, pepperoni pizza. Don't do that, okay? So don't do ham, as ham is no good and stuff. Now, that's land animals. What about sea creatures? Sea creatures. Two rules for sea creatures. Sea creatures got to have, do it this way. What's normal for a fish? Has scales and has fins. Is that a normal fish? Has scales and fins. So do you see how that normality thing fits in here? Skin. Now, that means what? Bass good? Bass good, trout good, pike, northern pike good, walleye good, what other game fish do we eat? Salmon good, halibut good, yeah. Tell me about catfish. What's the problem with catfish? Scales and fins. So you guys ever pick up catfish? Catfish has got what on it? Skin? Okay, yeah, it's skin. It's just like skin. It's like an eel. An eel, skin. Stuff, so they don't do catfish and things, okay? But they do. By the way, I don't think they do lobster either.
Also, like catfish, because
I
know
my
uncle
still loves to make catfish. Yeah. And the skin is like rubber after a few minutes of being left out. Yeah.
You have to eat it right after it's cooked.
Yeah. Yeah. Catfish. I actually, I grew up, my dad used to catch catfish too. I like catfish, but it just, you're Jewish, it's not and stuff. Yeah, Heather? That's another thing people suggest, that because they're bottom feeders and things like that, that there's also more chance for disease and things like that. I look back and I say, that may be, but I like this idea of normal, that a fish, normal. I think I take that over the bottom dwellers, because the other one that we never ate was carp. Carp are suckers on the bottom, but they've got fins and scales. And so I'd rather eat a catfish than a carp any day. But anyways, I'm sorry, but okay. Yeah, let's get on with this here. We got flying creatures. Flying creatures. What kind of flying creatures? No birds of prey. No birds of prey. What are birds of prey? Birds of prey are birds that eat blood, okay? Do you get the notion that eating blood is not good? The Jewish people are not allowed to eat blood. Birds of prey eat blood. So hawk, would a hawk be, could you eat a hawk or no? No hawk. Vultures, good or bad? Bad, okay. Owls, good or bad? Bad. Okay, any of these kind of birds that eat birds of prey, like vultures, hawks, owls, that kind of stuff. What about pheasants? Pheasants, good. I got a family of turkeys that come every day in my yard now. I've got 5 turkeys that come out there, and they eat in our yard and stuff. Are turkeys good? Turkeys good. What other kind of birds? Oh, quails. Did the Jews eat quail? Do we know that? Remember the quails and stuff like that. So now, the fourth one here is insects. They actually allow them to eat insects. Hoppers, yes. Flyers, no. Hoppers, yes. Flyers, no. Can you tell me somebody that ate grasshoppers? Does anybody know from the Bible? It was somebody who ate grasshoppers. Yes. John the Baptist. Yeah, he ate grasshoppers and things. When I was out in Sinai, Aura, who is our tour guide, we were out in Sinai for 3 weeks, she made us walk everywhere. She said, you're not riding, you're walking. And she made us walk. And at one place, she said, I'm going to have you walk up here. We had to walk over the ridge and stuff. And she said, when you go up there, she said, be careful about these black grasshoppers. They have black grasshoppers. In the desert are many things poisonous in the desert. They only get like one chance to strike, and so many are poisonous. She said these black grasshoppers will spit, and it's like a bee sting that they will spit. And he says if it hits you in the eye, it will poke out your eye. So we're out there walking down this path, and guess what? All of a sudden, man, right in front of us, boom, a black grasshopper sits like that, right? So I see this black grasshopper. I said, hey, man, I came all the way over from America. I get to see a black grasshopper. I'm going to get a picture of this thing. So I'm trying to get down. I get glasses, see? It doesn't work. And I got a camera. They hit the camera. So I'm getting down this black grasshopper. My wife, meanwhile, is screaming, black grasshopper, run! Run, black grasshopper! So take it off. I'm trying to get this picture. The problem was when you do it without a telephoto lens, what's the problem? The black grasshopper, my picture, is just a little piece of black, and I totally blew the picture and stuff. So anyways, this is a disaster. So, but anyway, stay away from black grasshoppers. But by the way, grasshoppers, I always said, put grasshoppers in batter, call them chicken wings. Nobody will know the difference. So anyways, do insects have high protein? Yeah. And so insects, hoppers, yes. Flyers, no. Now, yes, sir. Hoppers would be grasshoppers. Oh, grasshoppers, locusts, that kind of thing. Whereas flyers would be things like bees and, you know, things, mosquitoes and stuff. You know, so hoppers, yes. Flyers, no. Now, 3 problems that come up, and we'll just stay. If we finish this slide, we'll call it a day. I had a friend, Kevin Carr, who's in secular university. Guy in the secular university said the Bible's full of scientific errors. So Kevin, being a wisecracker, he always raises his hand and says, I've read the Bible through several times, and I've never seen any scientific errors. The professor says, oh, really? You've read the whole Bible, right? What about Leviticus chapter 11, verse 6? And you can just see Kevin cringing. Leviticus, he's a Christian. Does he know Leviticus? Leviticus. And so the professor says, in Leviticus chapter 11, verse 6, it says the rabbit chews its cud. The rabbit does not chew its cud. By the way, is that true? In order to chew a cud, you need how many stomachs? Do you need multiple stomachs to chew cud? The rabbit doesn't chew his cud. Is that correct? That is correct. However, is the Bible always talking in scientific terms? Does the rabbit always like chewing on things? Now, it's possible. Is this the language of appearance? In other words, the language of appearance, not necessarily a scientific description, that it's actually cud come up from their stomach, but that the rabbit chews its food over and over and over again. Okay. Is it also possible that this term rabbit is a mistranslation and it's really talking about a rock badger? Okay. In other words, when you go between countries and you're 3,000 years different, it's possible that you've got the translation wrong between animals. Animals are hard to translate. Some animals are hard to translate. So it could be a translation problem. It could be that it's just the language of appearance. The second one, bats. The bats are considered birds. In chapter 11, verse 19, it says the bats is grouped with the birds and you don't mess with the bats. I had a Probo. I told you about this guy named Probo in prison. Probo was an unbeliever, came in prison. Probo puts up his hand, he gets in class, he says, Professor, I found an error in the Bible. And it says that the bats are birds. And she says, everybody knows that bats aren't birds. I ask you, a tomato, what is it?
It's a fruit.
It's a fruit. Question, what happens if you're in another culture and they call a tomato a vegetable? Is that a big... Does the whole world have to use the American classification system? A bat does what? Does a bat fly like a bird and things like that? You say, well, a bat's a mammal. Did they have to... did they have to follow exactly our classification system? No. No, they classified things differently, obviously, than we do. So it's just a matter of classification difference and stuff. You missed the whole point there and things. The third thing that's a problem in the book of Leviticus that a lot of people have trouble with is this prohibition against homosexual behavior and stuff. Leviticus chapter 18, verse 22, and chapter 20, verse 13, two passages that come out really and say, man shouldn't sleep with another man kind of thing. And so those are three problems in the book of Leviticus and things that are there. Now, what we will do next time is talk about the sacrificial system. And so what we want to do next time, we'll go through the sacrificial system. We will finish Leviticus next time. So take care. Have a good time with a long week here. Days off.
This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his Old Testament History and Literature course, lecture number 13, on the book of Leviticus.